It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, it. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
Exterminate!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 93.
Spinning the Von Neumann roulette wheel to see what comes up, because we've got nothing better to do with our sad little lives.
I'm Sean.
And I'm Jen.
And we're doing an impromptu discussion episode because, sadly, we've had some issue where the interviewee hasn't shown up, and we think she was kidnapped. So
kidnapped. She better have been kidnapped.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, we will kidnap her.
So what we've done is we've kind of taken an impromptu series of random stuff we've discovered. We put out a random call on Twitter, and we got a topic that we're going to discuss from Paul Weimer. I think that's his name. I didn't check. But in any case, that's what we're going to do. So where do you want to start, Jen?
Let's start with Paul's question.
Okay. When is fantasy urban fantasy? When has fantasy become urban fantasy? Is that the exact quote? When is fantasy urban fantasy and when is it not? That's the exact quote. That's a really good question.
It is a good question because theoretically, stuff set in medieval times, that's urban. Like if you
Depending
pick
on,
a random
yeah.
city and I'm going to go with Lowtown. Lowtown is almost an urban fantasy to
it
me.
It is, yeah.
Because it's set in an urban environment and it's very much steeped in that urban environment. I mean, like the whole focus is that environment. It's almost a character unto itself. And so to me, that's almost an urban fantasy. But it's very much set in not now. So other people might disagree with me because I think some people would say that urban fantasy is fantasy that is contemporary. And probably set with an urban environment, although Charles DeLint doesn't necessarily always do that. And I think he would be considered urban fantasy.
It's really interesting. Yeah. I was looking on Wikipedia to see how Wikipedia defined urban.
Interesting.
And urban in it actually fits kind of what you're saying. It says specifically an urban area is characterized by higher population density and vast human features in comparisons to areas surrounding it. Urban
right.
areas may be cities, towns, or conurbations. I don't know what that is. But the term is not commonly extended to rural settlements such as villages and hamlets. Now, what's interesting is it then goes down a little bit later and makes a distinction. And it says this, unlike an urban area, a metropolitan area includes not only the urban area, but also satellite cities plus intervening rural land that is socioeconomically connected to the urban core city. Right.
Right.
This is, I think, a really interesting distinction because if we're going to really start thinking about how we define urban fantasy, really what we need to do is say urban fantasy is the umbrella term because really what we need to do is now say there's sort of medieval urban fantasy is its own section,
right.
And then there's metropolitan fantasy.
Right. Contemporary urban fantasy.
Or you could say that. I would say metropolitan, because most urban fantasy
right.
doesn't deal with just a single city, and it's implying that it's a metropolitan area.
Many do. There's a series set in Albuquerque. Albuquerque doesn't really have much of a metropolitan area. I suppose it isn't necessarily stuck in Albuquerque, but I don't know.
Is that the one I gave you, Kevin Hearn? He's in Arizona.
No. That's
in Arizona. Yeah.
It's a different one. I can't think of the name of it right now. But, you do have some that are set very much in single cities. however, like if you go with Dresden's, the Dresden Files.
Right, by Butcher, yeah.
Butcher, thank you. Sorry. I just, decided to name him Dresden after his books. Anyway, if you go with the Dresden Files, Chicago is definitely the focus, but there See, that's almost a metropolitan fantasy because it extends past the urban boundaries of Chicago to encompass the suburbs, which would make it a metropolitan area. So, however, if we're going with, if you want to kind of cut that as a complication to what is urban fantasy, I think the standard definition these days would be things that are set in contemporary, recognizable spaces.
City spaces.
When I say recognizable, I mean like real. Not necessarily made up spaces.
Oh, so you're making a distinction then that something that, for example, would have a city but it's not a real city is no longer urban fantasy. That would
exactly.
be something else.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. This is why I think
That's
we need
saying,
that
which
umbrella
Which is why term. Lowtown, to some people's definition of what urban fantasy is, and I'm going with a generally accepted definition of what urban fantasy is here, because I think that things like Lowtown could be considered urban fantasy. However, if you're going with the generally accepted definition, which I think is contemporary recognizable spaces with fantasy woven in, Lowtown does not apply to that. But it's very, very urban fantasy-ish.
Yeah, and that's, I think that's the very problem, I think, with urban fantasy, is that it provides you this template of what an urban fantasy is, but that template really applies very broadly across a variety. Yeah.
Yes, it could apply incredibly broadly. However, I think that, as I said, generally accepted definition, modern, contemporary, recognizable spaces with fantasy elements woven in. I think that's kind of how you have to draw the line these days. So, and that still encompasses a great deal. I mean, you then also have to make a distinction between magical realism and urban fantasy.
Well, I think that distinction is a little more clear.
Right, to an extent, because urban fantasy has much more magic woven than, say, magical realism does.
Right, magical realism, I mean, I define it as de-emphasized magic.
Right. Right. And the characters are definitely more important, I think, in magical realism than the setting per se, although not necessarily.
Yeah, because magical realism isn't necessarily set in cities. I mean, it's magical realism isn't all-encompassing. It could be set in a farm or anything.
Right. But I would say that some urban fantasy could be considered magical realism. But I think there's much more of a focus on character drama in magical realism than there is on other things.
I would not.
I think we've answered the question.
Okay.
If we didn't, then he can yell at us.
Well, he will. I'm sure. He can cry about it. Jerk. No, I'm just kidding. Totally teasing. We'll make sure if we got the name wrong, because he's Prince Justin with a V on, and I'm pretty sure it's Paul Weimer. I'm making sure. But in any case, I'll put a link to the loveliness that is him on the interwebs.
thank you for the question, by the way.
Yeah, really good. And thank you for coming up with it like on the last second like that. So the other thing I really wanted to talk about is news just came out today through Tor.com that Stephen Moffat has chosen his next companion for the Doctor in Doctor Who. I'm a huge Doctor Who fan. Jen has not seen season 6, so we're going to be very careful not to ruin that for her.
Yes, do not mention the last season. I will kill you all.
Yeah,
spoil anything.
Yeah, the new person that's going to be in it is Jenna Louise Coleman, who is probably best known for being in the soap opera Emmerdale. I've not seen Emmerdale, but that seems to be the one that most people know her from. She also had a small part in Captain America, the First Avenger, and she's in some Titanic miniseries, which I've never heard of, and it's, again, one of those things that I don't want to see because I already know how it ends. It's a prequel. That's essentially what it is. It just serves no purpose except to take us to the moon. But anyway, whatever. Right? She's been selected as a new Doctor. Now, we don't know much about who she is, what kind of character she's playing, etc. So a lot of my apprehensions about her selection may actually go away once her character is revealed. Because I'm going to watch it no matter what. So whatever.
They might. And Moffat has hinted that it's not going to be your typical boy meets girl. However, the casting choice, I think, kind of
It's going with what he implied he was going with when he selected Matt Smith, which is he's trying to hit the younger audience.
The younger audience, which I appreciate to an extent. But at the same time, I don't see how it couldn't be a typical boy meets girl when she's this... I don't even know how old she is. She looks 25. Like 14. Okay, she's 25.
Born in 86.
But she's a typical young hot chick. I mean, at least she's not blonde, I suppose. Nothing against blondes, but that is kind of the typical young hot chick that people go with. And that's a little bit disappointing.
Yeah. Well, let me look at a picture real quick. Just pause. Okay, I'm going to give her props for this. She is not just any other skinny model. She's a well-filled out woman. I'm looking at pictures. Yeah, I mean, she's obviously, you know, she's in shape, but she's not just like a stick thin woman.
Well, that's good.
Well, and to be fair, I mean, I think that's been fairly clear throughout the series that they don't just choose stick thin people. I mean, you think the thinnest person they've had has been Amy Pond.
Probably
the thinnest person they had. Or maybe Martha. Yeah.
Okay, anyway, but if you're going, she's still young and hot. And
I agree, but I'm going to give her props. Even though I still have apprehensions, I'm giving her props because they didn't just choose some like really stick-thin model girl. Yeah, like, they went with someone who's curvy. She's very curvy. So
I don't see many curves, but okay, whatever.
She's curvy. Yeah,
she's curvy. It's curvy by your definitions, but let's be honest, you like flat chicks. So
what? She's not flat. I'm sorry. She is well-endowed, thank you.
Yes. By your definitions of well endowed.
Are you even looking?
Well endowed. Yes, I'm looking. I have different definitions of well endowed because of my own breast size. Totally inappropriate for the show, but I'm just letting you all know.
Okay.
I have different definitions from Duke.
Okay,
so,
well, let me say what my apprehension is.
Okay.
And I'm sure it's as similar as your apprehension. We talked about this before, but my apprehension is that I really wanted them to choose a companion that would have challenged the sort of typical Hollywood feel. And I feel like the Doctor Who, his companions have been traditionally a challenge to that to some extent. I mean, Rose was maybe a somewhat semi-typical selection, although, again, she's not one of those stick-thin models. And then you had Donna Noble, who was very, you know, she's not your typical hot chick, right? She's an older woman who... I think she's beautiful, but she's very beautiful in a very different way from what Hollywood thinks is beautiful.
Right.
Right. And then you had Martha, who, let's admit, she's black, so she's a different type of companion that we're used to in film and in television particularly. And then they went to Amy, which at first seemed just like, you know, typical kind of here's a hot, feisty chick. But then it was like, no, we're going to add in the weird dynamic with the family. And then the really weird dynamic with like the almost incestuous relationship with the Doctor's wife, not the Doctor's wife, that's the wrong episode, what's her name? River Song. Mm-hmm. This very strange relationship there, which I'm not going to say anything else about because Jen has not seen the next series.
Thank you.
But anyway, I just really wanted there to be a challenge. And one of the things was Tempest Bradford had posted her 10 selections of who she thought the next Doctor's companion should be. And there were selections in there that I thought were such perfect choices. I mean,
they're
there were
wonderful.
Right, there was characters you're not intimately familiar with, but Vostra and Jenny, who were in season 6. But of course, she's one of the lizard people, so she shows up in one of the previous ones. I thought that would have been very interesting. They had Matthew Shepard, not Matthew Shepard. Whoa, wrong person. Wrong
Mark
person.
Shepard.
Mark Shepard. Oh my God. Whew, that was way wrong. Him would have been very interesting because he would have been someone that's pre the contemporary time and also someone who is gay.
And an excellent actor.
They had Alonzo, the guy who played Alonzo, the big ears, he's in Being Human. Not the American one, the original one.
The original one, the good right. one.
Again, a character who is implied to be gay, but is also a little kind of funny, weird kind of, yeah. They even recommended a character that's in the next season, which Jen hasn't seen, who is I forget her name of her character because she's only in one episode, but she's a Muslim character, and I really would have liked to have seen her, or at least the actress, return. I thought
because she was really good.
She was really good.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, they have an interesting series. They also have a couple that I'm like, oh, okay, whatever, don't care.
Yeah.
But I like the list overall, and it's a much more interesting, diverse list. And they've only got two white people on this whole list. I mean, which is very nice.
A little bit more than two. But the types of white three. People they've chosen are varied.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. They're exactly. They're people
and
who buck a trend
Doctor
in some sense.
Who, though, on one hand, you know, is kind of smashes sort of the borders and of both sexuality and race and species and everything. At the same time, we've had primarily white doctors with white companions. Martha Jones being the exception.
Yeah.
And,
I just
and
want more exceptions.
I want more. Exactly. I want more exceptions because I want them to take the relations that they've kind of set up with aliens and whatnot between the Doctor and aliens, other aliens, I should say, and his relationship with humans. You know, that would be refreshing. And they haven't done that with this. And that's, it's just a little disappointing.
Yeah. And we may be very wrong about this.
We could be.
You know, and if people want to say that we're wrong and they want to challenge this, please, please do. I would love to have a discussion about this. And in fact, I would love to be wrong.
And maybe she's amazing. We've never seen her work. Although we've seen Avenger, I have no Captain America. I have no idea who she was.
I can't remember, but I did see Captain America.
Small parts, I'm assuming. That's and good. I have not seen any of her other work. So she could be at least an amazing actress. And I don't doubt that. They've done a great job of picking their cast in terms of acting ability. But again, that I don't think acting ability really diminishes the issues that the other issues I have.
Yeah, I think that's essentially the issue we're having is we just wanted this to challenge some trends because it's a show that quite honestly is in a position where it can do that.
Exactly. And usually the Brits do a hell of a lot better than that than Americans.
Yeah, and that kind of brings us to the other thing that we saw that we wanted, we thought about talking about, which is an article from Geek.com by Russell Hawley about the death of American SF. And we've only kind of glanced at it. But one of the things that it talks about is how the BBC has sort of destroyed, in a way, what the U.S. has brought to the table in terms of genre fiction on television. And that's, I think, not just obvious. I think that's plainly quite true. I mean, you have, just off the top of my head, shows that you could talk about. Doctor Who, Being Human, Merlin. What else have they got that's been running?
Well, that's running recently? I don't know, but I've gone back through and watched a few BBC sci-fi series. What was the other one? The one about the end of the world, everybody dies off because of a virus and it's the people that are surviving. That was a few years ago and was amazing. You have Sherlock Holmes.
Which is vaguely genre-ish.
Genre. They've done in the past 10 years. They don't necessarily have a lot running right now. I don't know. Maybe they have more that I'm just not aware of than those three. But
the quality is really what matters.
The quality is so high that pretty much anything that the Americans throw out there is just kind of like, and most of our shows end up failing, which is interesting because we definitely have an audience for Doctor Who. One would think that they would also watch some other shows.
Well, let's be really clear and honest about one thing. When we say that most of our shows are failing, well, that's also because we have an enormous television, arena. And
right.
The fact of the matter is a lot of stuff just going to fail just by nature.
Yeah. I mean, that is very true. But right now, it has been disappointing recently. I have to deal with the fact that sci-fi canceled Eureka, and I only get, 6 more episodes, and then I'm going to have to kill myself.
And
I know you
nothing.
Don't watch
Although,
Eureka, but I fucking love that show, excuse my language.
Can I just get really excited for a second, though? Did finally see a sneak peek of Blood and Chrome. Battlestar Galactica's Blood and Chrome.
Oh, right.
Which was hidden on YouTube. I'm going to post it on my blog. It looks, and part of my French, fucking amazing. I mean, does far it? And but above
BSG.
Is that
going to be a mini series? Is that going to be online? I mean, it's...
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. All I know is that there are good shows being made in America. I think the big problem is they're made on, like, smaller networks like Sci-Fi or they're made on cable networks. I mean, like, I understand that on Stars, for example, they have, like, what, Spartacus and stuff, which are genre. I mean, he's talking sci-fi, but really he's talking just any genre fiction. Because
all I can figure is that the BBC has a different model in terms of how they judge the whether or not a show should be on. Plus, usually their shows are made for a slightly lower budget.
Which means the writing's higher, yeah.
Right. And in the States, we have, except for sci-fi, the production values on most science fiction shows are higher than even Doctor Who was in the beginning, which is usually completely unnecessary, frankly. And they're trying to still make a return on it, which means that they have to sell ad space, which means that they have to have the viewership. And if it's not there, it gets canceled, regardless of the quality show. Because if you're making something for too much, I mean, that's essentially, I think, what happened with, the Stargate universe.
Okay,
Too expensive. It was just flat out too expensive. It was a great show. I mean, I don't know if you
I saw most of the first season. I thought it had a lot of potential, but I had lots of reservations.
The first season was not anywhere near as good as the second, for one thing. The second was just blew it out of the water for me. It did have a ton of potential. It could have gone some really fascinating places, but it was just too expensive for them to make. And it didn't have the viewership to justify it long term. And that happens with a great deal of science fiction shows that are made in the United States, partially because people in the US expect a certain level of production value. And that's not cheap, at least based on what they're watching. They don't expect a higher production value if they're watching a sitcom. The viewership can be fairly low and they still make a ton of money. I mean, that's why things like The Big Bang Theory have been such a huge success, is because it doesn't cost them a lot to make, but they make a ton of money off it because a ton of people are still watching it. But it's also only a half-hour show. Then you have things like, say, Fringe. That is more expensive to produce. That has been at risk for a long time. But it's also a different type of science fiction. It's more like, you know, X-Files.
Yeah, yeah.
And what they're doing with it. It's not, yes, it's science fiction, but you still have, you know, the weird character drama. It's more of a thriller. And the U.S. audience, I think, goes for that a little bit more. And so they can still maintain those viewership levels. Things like Jericho, Terra Nova. Terra Nova sucked. I'm sorry.
I didn't want to watch it. I thought it sounded dumb.
I watched like two episodes and it was just horrible. What else? The alien show that was out last year.
Fallen Skies.
Fallen Skies.
Fallen
not
Skies
successful.
Fallen. I don't remember. I watched like four episodes of that and I gave up.
Yeah, it dealt with way too many stereotypical sort of.
That's the problem. Is it's like it's dealing with all of these stereotypes, you know? But then you look at the BBC stuff and it's like, yeah, it's got all the stereotypes, but then
it breaks them
by having these immensely amazing writing for characters. Like, look at Sherlock Holmes. Like, Sherlock Holmes is already a cliche because he's Sherlock fucking Holmes, right? But then what did they do? They wrote possibly one of the most brilliant representations of Sherlock Holmes, a representation that I think completely blows the Robert Downey Jr. films out of the water.
Oh, I don't even want to watch. Like, this last time, because I had seen Sherlock Holmes, the BBC version, the last movie that came out, I was like, why would I bother? It's going to be so dumb in comparison.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's so brilliant. They're so clever in how they had put these together. The acting is superb. Benedict Cumberbatch is amazing. And Martin Freeman as Watson is just amazing. I mean, the acting is just top notch.
Oh, yeah.
And yet it's a film, it's a show that, quite honestly, it doesn't need a large budget. I mean,
no, it doesn't.
It just needs to put him in a nice coat and have him act like a crazy person. I mean, that's basically it. And he does it. Well, I'm reducing it way too much, but
no, I think that pretty much covers it.
Yeah. It's just, I feel And I don't know if maybe this has something to do with BBC's history and that the BBC is funded by the public. It comes out of the public funding. That maybe to some extent this has to do with it, that the BBC, whoever the people are that are responsible for the programming, they have to sit there and say, we have this year $50 to make shows. So which shows do we keep on and how many episodes do we have? Do we sacrifice a few episodes from this show so we can try this new show? You know, and they have to jostle all this around. Whereas in here, it's like, we've got $50 billion and we've got 24 hours in which to put shit on. So do we cancel this show and try some other shit or what? Like, I mean, I'm not being fair to our TV, obviously.
You're not. But
it feels like that. It feels like there's so much attention trying to make these shows that lack the emotional impact. And it's like, you know, when Sci-Fi did BSG, which I know I keep coming back to it, but it was so brilliant precisely because of the characters were central. It wasn't the other stuff.
And fairly low production costs.
And they did pretty good work with low production costs.
Exactly. I mean, it was still it's pricey compared to a standard American drama series. But not that much more expensive. So, and because of who was on the show, who they picked as their cast, I have a feeling that their cast was less expensive overall than many of the shows that, you know, can demand the higher paid actors for recognition value. And I think that's actually a problem with a lot of American television, is that they go with actors for recognition value and not necessarily chops.
Yeah, that's to some extent true, with the exception that with BSG, I mean, they had Edward almost, who
exactly. Awesome. It was just amazing. No, I mean, that's what I'm saying. And I actually think that most science fiction in the United I shouldn't say most science fiction. Much of the science fiction that's made at the lower budgets do choose cast for acting chops. I mean, that's why you have things like Eureka has a great cast. They have never disappointed me in acting value. BSG, Stargate Universe, most of the Stargate series, great actors, and it didn't cost them too much long term, because they kept those costs down. The special effects were cheesy, but nobody cared because they were led along with a great story and great actors. And that's nice. The stuff that's getting on mainstream, like the you know, cable, that's not what they're doing. They're going with the high production costs. They're going with the high paid actors for the most part, not entirely, but for the most part. And I think they're sacrificing something by doing that.
But
that could be the nature of the American market too. So the question now that I have is, if American science fiction is dying, at least in television, is it because the BBC is killing it?
No, it's not because the BBC is killing it. It's the U.S. is killing itself.
Well, you have to think, though.
It's not.
We
it's
have
not.
Such
BBC's
high
not
expectations
enough.
Because of the BBC?
No, because the BBC in the U.S., its numbers are not nearly high enough to even suggest that that's a true statement. Their numbers
except
are fairly...
Except for diehard fans.
Except for diehard fans. I mean, their numbers are pretty good, but they're not... The BBC here, for example, I mean, it's not a public station, for one.
I know. I don't even get it.
I have to find clever ways to watch it online, exactly. Which Sad means case. I'm breaking the rules, but primarily because I just really can't afford cable. If I could just buy the BBC and pay $5 a month for the BBC, I probably would. But
so true.
But that's the fact. Like, the numbers aren't as big.
Why
here.
Don't they do it that way, where you can just pay for a single channel? That's not HBO or Starz or something.
There's a reason for it, and I don't really know what it is.
Stupid reason.
PBS
I don't know
does
what it
play
is.
Some BBC stuff, though, but
they
license it, like, after, like, a year or something. I don't remember.
Yeah, well, like, recently, Downton Abbey obviously came on PBS, but not my PBS station.
Oh, I wonder how that works. Maybe it's regional. That's interesting.
Well, PBS theoretically is regional. They have stations. So,
sure.
But I would have expected it. Bay Area, PBS? I mean, for frack's sake. I don't know.
You would think
I would,
so.
Maybe I just couldn't find it and I'm an idiot, but I was really disappointed because I love Downton Abbey.
Well, you get Netflix, so that's how you kind of solve some of your problem, I guess. And I should say, when I was saying the numbers, I don't know what those numbers are reflected through something like Netflix, because that I don't think they generally keep track of those numbers.
Yeah.
Through services like Netflix or Hulu Plus, which would be very interesting. I would be very interested to know what do TV programs, whoever produces it or whatever, what do the numbers look like when they're through other sources of watching it?
I don't know, but I mean, there's a reason that things like Netflix has explored, you know, continuing TV shows on Netflix, to just offer it on Netflix. Canceled television shows like Terra Nova, unfortunately, which sucked, so they probably shouldn't do that. But that has been mentioned. They're doing it with Arrested Development. There's all new content for Arrested Development on Netflix, which is fantastic for people who like that show.
Did they already start it?
I don't know if they have or not. I've never watched Arrested Development. I've seen two episodes.
It's good.
I know it is. It's like Doctor Who. It took me 10 years.
That makes sense.
And then I had to watch the entire series. And I still haven't watched BSG because I kept falling asleep. Communist. I'm sorry. I am.
You're a commie. Yeah. All right. Well, why don't we close out? We're about at a half hour now of recording time. So
excellent.
So if anybody would like to offer your opinions, and obviously this is impromptu, so we probably got a lot of things wrong, and that's perfectly fine if you want to correct us or offer your contrary opinion, or if you just want to agree with us. We really like it when we have our egos soothed.
Makes us feel
special. Yeah.
I like being soothed.
Yeah. So if you would like to do that, it's easy. There's four simple ways you can do it. You can, of course, go to our blog. I just started.
I know. It didn't even take a second. I'm like, Shawnee Jen? Wait, no, that's
wrong.
Right?
Let me try that again.
I've been screwed up ever since we switched to skiffyandfanty.com as opposed to skiffyandfanty.wordpress.com.
Well, wordpress.com actually works too, by the way.
Oh, well, then that helps. But anyway, our web address...
Wait, hold on. Let me start over.
Fine.
If you'd like to leave a comment, go to our website.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
You can go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
Twitter?
Twitter.com/SkiffyandFanty.
Or if you'd like to remain anonymous and a coward, you can... I'm just kidding. You can go to our email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com. I'm not entirely sure how you could be anonymous on the email since your email address would pop up. You could probably be more anonymous by sending us a comment because there's that whole anonymous button.
Fair enough. Whatever. Just shut up. I was joking. Anywho, so thanks for listening to this episode, and we'll figure out what we're going to do for next week. So.
Yes, we will. Hopefully it'll be something exciting and amazing.
It will. Stina. Yeah. Cool. All right, guys. Have a good one.
Bye.
Our new intro music is Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.